Thank you. Today I'm going to take a little bit of departure of what most talks have been talking about, and I'm going to talk about two of several neo-ichnology experiments that myself and my co-author, Steve Hasiotis, are working on, which are looking at Western harvester ants and the role that they're playing in soil development. So the objectives or our research question here is, what specifically or what role does the Western harvester ant play specifically in soil bioturbation and soil pedogenesis? And within this question, we're interested in really a few things. One, how does a Western harvester ant mix the soils? Two, what is the difference between subsurface mixing and the mixing that's occurring at the surface? And then finally, can this mixing be quantified? Now, these two experiments are really the latest in a line of experiments that have been going on at the University of Kansas that, at least in some part, are all related to this biota impact into this very typical model of soil development. Now, what these experiments are showing is that biota actually is playing a fairly large role and perhaps even a misunderstood role in soil bioturbation, not only in modern soils or present soil, but also in paleosols throughout Earth's history. Now, in terms of soil bioturbation, what exactly are we talking about? What kind of organisms? This is probably a little bit of review for most people, but of course we have earthworms. We have our small mammals, and it's not just small mammals, but we also can have animals such as coyotes, so large mammals can also have an impact on the soils. We have tree throw, soil microorganisms and soil bacteria, and then of course our soil insects, which is what this talk is going to be focused on. So our termites, and then, of course, our ants. And all these soil bioturbators, they've been studied extensively, and what the literature lacks is, again, an underappreciation of what's going on below the surface. So most of these soil surface, or most of these bioturbation studies, especially our insect studies, are solely focused on what is going on above the surface. Because after all, you know, with this termite mound, what you see is that activity above the surface. So, every childhood dream, we created a really big ant farm. And so our first experiment was based on an ant farm that was basically 36 by 36 centimeters, and a centimeter and a half thick. We introduced 50 ants to the experiment. We set up the experiment to emulate a typical entosol with a buried soil that you may find in the Western Great Plains. And the experiment went on for 6 weeks. And yes, these are toy soldiers, and they actually served a purpose because they measured the rate of deposition on the surface. Now, with our first experiment, what we were primarily concerned with is getting an idea of nest ontogeny or nest development. How does the nest develop through time? And then also taking a look at the specific burrowing behaviors that the ants use when constructing, excavating, and redepositing this material in their nest. So after the 6 weeks experiment, this is our end result. And what we can see just right out from this slide is we have a significant amount of mixing going on. And as you might expect, most of this mixing is occurring at the surface, in the mound, after all the ants are moving material upward and depositing at the surface. But you can also see, just in the lining of the nest walls, a couple of areas here, here, and area down here a little washed out by glare from the glass, but these areas also show mixing, and it's mixing that occurred when the ants were actually taking material back down into the nest and backfilling their galleries and chambers. So if we zoom in on a couple of different areas just to show you a better idea of what's going on with the mixing, here's some mixing of the surface mound sediment. We actually have normal grading occurring, which was absolutely amazing, but we have coarser particles at the bottom and finding upwards. We have backfill galleries and chambers that were subsequently reopened by the ants. So they went through, they filled them up, and then they went back and reopened them. And then we also have areas deep down in the nest that have been completely backfilled by sediment from above. And then we also have areas in the nest that are higher up that are also backfilled. So a wide variety of mixing that's going on. Now the results of this first experiment, like I said, the primary objective was to look at nest ontogeny and burrowing behaviors, but our results of this experiment, we actually documented several unique, including one new burrowing behavior that hasn't been in the literature yet, which we call forcing. So we document these burrowing behaviors. We actually have videotape of the ants doing it, so it's a good study from that standpoint. And we also have we identified a specific pattern of nest ontogeny, of excavation and then subsequential backfilling of the nest. And we hope to have this out very soon. It's in review right now. The most important thing that we noted in this first experiment was that there was significant mixing of soils, not just at the surface of the nest, but deep down to the bottom of the enclosure. And so then we got this great idea. We said, okay, well, if we're seeing this really good mixing, let's make an even bigger ant nest. And so we did. So our second experiment was with an ant nest that was 64 centimeters wide by about 100 centimeters high, and this one is 10.7 centimeters wide. And in this experiment, we introduced 1,000 ants, so we ramped up the number of ants quite a bit. Instead of having a specific soil profile, we decided to introduce specific sediment layers from the bottom. We have carbonate shells, red sand, some alluvial gravel, green sand, pink gravel, yellow sand, blue gravel, and we let the ants burrow for a little bit longer, twice as long, 12 weeks. Now, the reason behind doing this experiment, what we're looking for in this experiment, are two specific things. We want to specifically look at the patterns of mixing that is going on in the nest, and then we also want to see if we can quantify the movement of sediment, whether that be the distance, the frequency, or even the actual quantity of individual sediment that's been moved. So after the experiment, we show similar results to the first experiment, just ramped up. We have mixing occurring at the surface. We have mixing occurring within the nest itself. We show that the ants are moving material upward, moving material downward. The ants have excavated through the entire enclosure. Some more specific examples of mixing. Here we have our blue gravel layer, and here we have a backfill gallery system that's been completely backfilled with yellow sand, which is from a horizon below the blue. Here we have yellow sand, and it's very washed out, but there's actually a nice big chunk of pink gravel that for whatever reason the ants just decided to leave right there. Here we have, in our green sediment horizon, a backfill gallery backfilled with yellow sediment. So this sediment came from above and was moved down into the nest to backfill. Here we have, again, in the lower reaches of the enclosure, just a jumbled up mix of all kinds of different sediment. We have red sand from below, carbonate shells from below, we have yellow sand from above, and we actually have a piece of blue gravel that's been moved down from above into these lower horizons. What this picture is showing you is, again, some more mixing that's occurring with the backfill, but what we have, and it's probably a little washed out for you in the back of the room, but plant material is incorporated into this backfill. So not only was sediment moved down into the nest, but we also have plant material from the top, from the surface of the nest, being brought all the way down into the nest and incorporated into the backfill. And then finally, just to round out the slide, we show that we have some mixing occurring in the deepest, most reached corners of the enclosure. So to quantify the mixing of sediment, we looked at two things. The first one being a distancy and frequency of sediment movement. Now to calculate this, what we did was we took digital photos and we lined them up with a digital grid in Adobe Illustrator, and we simply counted the occurrence of individual sediments at depth. So for example, if we had yellow sand and it showed up within this 1 centimeter by 1 centimeter grid, we counted that as one occurrence. And this worked fairly well because we're not looking at a specific quantity here, we're looking at a distance and a frequency at a specific distance. To calculate the volume of sediment moved, I simply took a cylinder volume equation from my geometry textbook and jumbled it up a little bit to make it fit or to work with the tunnel structure that the ants were creating. And with this equation, we're able to estimate the amount of material that the ants actually move from each horizon. So our results, and I recognize that this slide is fairly busy, so I'm going to zoom in on a couple examples in a moment here. But these are the results of our distribution or distance and frequency distribution. Now what you can see, three things are important in this diagram. The first one being, as you might suspect, the majority of our specific sediment layers were moved to the surface of the nest. And that's expected. After all, we know that ants are excavating material to the surface. What maybe is not expected is that we have a significant amount of material moved from each of these horizons being deposited throughout the entire nest. And then the third thing that this shows, or that this diagram shows, that also is perhaps not expected, is that we not only have the upward movement and deposition of these sediments, but we also have the downward movement and deposition of these sediments. If we look at a couple of examples a little bit closer, what we can see, again, we have that distribution at the surface where most of our sediment has been deposited. But what we also noticed is that we have a normal distribution of sediment away from our original sediment layers. So for example, in our yellow sand layer, we started at this depth, and the ants not only moved this sediment upwards, and as they moved it away, they deposited less and less and less until they got to the surface, but they also had that same pattern occurring as they moved down into the nest. And so we're showing this normal distribution of sediment away from the original sediment layer, both upwards and downwards in the nest. Now our volumetric estimates, or our calculations, Again, these are the results of those. What's important of this is that we show, of the total volume of the enclosure, we show that the ants excavated approximately 8,500 cubic centimeters of sediment. And that's roughly 16.38% of the total enclosure. So the ants have excavated that amount of the enclosure. What this data also shows us is that the vast majority of all the excavations took place towards the surface. And so this tells us that in nature, the ants are having the most important influence on the upper parts of their nest, not necessarily the lower parts of their nest. But what's most significant of this second experiment is what occurred with the nest mound. And this is what I think is really cool and really important. Here is what the nest mound looked like prior to introducing of the ants. The original surface of the S mound is roughly in this location. After the 12-week experiment, we, one, have very little vegetation left, but two, we have quite a bit of deposition above the original surface. Now, we quantified, or we measured, the amount of material in the mound, and that amount of material came to 4,150 cubic centimeters. Now, what that means is that the mound sediment deposited by the ants only accounts for 49% of the total amount of excavated material. That also means that 51% of all the material excavated by the ants was not introduced to the mound. It was introduced back into the nest, whether it be through the backfilling of chambers and galleries, or whether it be in the lining of the nest walls. We can also take these data and we can quantify it in terms of a sediment mixing rate. Now, if we just look at our surface sediment alone, we have a sediment mixing rate of approximately 28 kilograms per year. When we include the subsurface mixing that's going on, we have quite a substantial increase in our mixing, or 58 kilograms per year. If we take these measurements and we apply it to a typical harvester ant-infested grassland, such as this, our rates are quite staggering, how much material is actually moved by ants. If we're just looking at the surface sediment alone, we have approximately 9 tons per hectare per year of sediment being moved by the ants. If we include the subsurface sediment, we almost have 19 tons per hectare per year. Now, what these results show us is that it's clear that the unseen mixing of soils and sediments play a significant role in soil bioturbation and pedogenesis. So to conclude, what we find is that sediments are moved by ants in three ways. They're moved from all horizons to the surface, they're moved from horizons to other horizons within the nest, and they're also moved from the surface down into the nest. The distance of sediment appears to be related to the enclosure. It's limited by the enclosure. It's not limited by the ants. If the ants could go down 15 meters, as these ants have been documented to do, they would move this sediment 15 meters into the soil. We show that 51% of the excavated material was not placed at the surface, but reincorporated somewhere back into the nest. And finally, we show that sediment mixing rates are much higher than when you include subsurface mixing than surface mixing alone. So in terms of future research, what we're working on is we're looking at other types of soil-dwelling organisms and trying to quantify not only the surface mixing but the subsurface mixing that's going on as well. And with future research, not only our own but in others' future research, we suggest that any research regarding sediment turnover or sediment mixing, that you have to take a look at the subsurface activity that's going on as well as the surface activity, because only accounting for surface mixing can substantially or significantly lower the true rates of mixing that's occurring in a soil. And with that, I'll thank you, including some laboratory help, Don and Diana Johnson, who were great with some helpful insight, and of course, some money people. I'll take any questions. Sure.
Really quick. Did you ever do any species differentiation?
That's one of the things we're working on right now, is we're looking at trying to take a look at a different harvester ants.
Different differentiation of species.
Yeah.
But then the other one is more of a direct question to you. But
sure.
I really enjoyed the talk. And through a set of circumstances beyond my control, I happen to have a dichotomous area of my Paracanthus longimembris or house guest. And I really want to find out where you got the colored sand.
I don't know.
They're terrariums. I mean, these guys completely turn over cubic meters of material in a terrarium in a period of 48 hours.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I've seen that, and I've often wondered how to quantify this. If we take a look at coccus areas underneath Creosote, which is the Mojave Desert, the amount of bioturbidation done by these small mammals is staggering. And my sense is even more than what you're seeing with the ants are comparable. So, this is really a nice, I look forward to your publication.
Good, thanks. Yes.
Just a sort of a follow-up question. I was wondering, what is the, sounds really strange, but what is sort of the behavior? In other words, when do they leave a mound to start another mound? So how do they distribute themselves across the landscape? Do you have any idea? What drives that? Is it seasonal, or is it?
Well, what the literature suggests in terms of the ants leaving their mound is that this species of harvester ants will leave their mound, or they'll make a new mound approximately three to four times every year. It also shows that activity is occurring between in the summer months or late spring to late fall. Why they leave a mound and go somewhere else, I suppose it could have to do with the food availability in the area. They're known to clear the vegetation around their mound, so if it's too much work for them to go out and forage for that food, I suppose that would be a deciding factor. What I do know is they will shut down parts of the nest and move the brood and the queen within the nest based on rainfall. And so in areas where you mainly found in semi-arid locations in the United States, if you have substantial rain, you can get flooding of the nest, in which case they may abandon that nest and move to another nest because of that as well.
We got one more question.
Thank you. So just quickly, if you compare what's above your initial blue line to the height of a standard harvester ant mound, can you get an idea of how much, because obviously you didn't rain on your experiment,
right,
for example, or anything like that?
Well, it didn't rain, but every day it got sprayed by water.
But lateral transport, overland flow.
Yeah, no, in terms of height of the actual mound, it's fairly small compared to what's found in nature. And one of the reasons is because we only had 1,000 ants. An average harvester ant nest that's not even mature has 4,000 ants. A mature nest has over 10,000. And so we have a very small nest, and so it's not accurate as to what you'd say find in nature in terms of the size of the mound.
Okay, was it cemented at all, or was
the nest cemented?
The material above the blue line, did they leave something behind, excrete something? That
no.
No,
we find that the ants do not excrete anything to line their walls. It's all, we call it forcing, and it's all pressure from their heads to push the materials into place. It's no excretions.
Thanks.
Thank you, Alan.
Yeah, thank you.